or 4X chair.
Good morning. Welcome to Radioactivity. I'm Rob Lori. First, thanks to all those people that made contributions yesterday. We heard from more than 47 people making contributions to WMNF as we try to close that gap here at MNF and to raise some money. We've lost a little bit of money in the last 5 weeks, and lots of great people have made contributions. You can make your contribution online at WMNF.org. Well, coming up, we're going to talk with a reporter who survived a newsroom massacre in Annapolis, Maryland last summer. And later, we'll talk with a Pulitzer Prize-winning writer for the Tampa Bay Times about the upcoming Tampa mayor's race. We'll also talk about some of the issues that are going on in Tallahassee. In June of last year, our next guest, a recent grad from the University of Tampa, was in the newsroom at her newspaper in Maryland, the Capital Gazette, when a gunman entered and started shooting. Celine Sanfilippo Police is a staff writer at the Gazette. She survived the massacre. Five of her co-workers were killed. Tonight at 5 p.m., she'll be speaking at the University of Tampa. She was among the people named Time Magazine's 2018 People of the Year. She'll be speaking tonight at the Loth Entrepreneurship Center at the University of Tampa. It's free and open to the public. It's all about careers in news media. I spoke with Celine Sanfilippo yesterday, and here's that interview. Celine, welcome to WMNF. It's nice to have you here.
Thank you so much for having me.
You were in the newsroom at your paper when this horrible tragedy occurred, and I don't want to make you feel uncomfortable. I certainly don't want to have to rehash the entire events, but could you briefly describe what happened the day you were in the newsroom?
Yeah, basically, I was in the newsroom, and a man with a gun came in and killed five of my coworkers. I was hiding under a desk, and there were 11 people in the newsroom that day, which is actually pretty small for what it usually is. And six of us made it out. So I was in there, and Rob Hyacin, Gerald Fishman, Rebecca Smith, Wendy Winters, and John McNamara were killed.
You graduated from UT just a few years ago. Did you ever expect anything like this to happen?
I was going to give you a very sarcastic answer, but I'm just going to say no. No. I mean, I remember when I was getting ready to go to UT for journalism. The Capital is my hometown paper, so I'm from Maryland. And my mom took me to the Newseum in D.C. And I remember sitting in the memorial room reading the names of journalists who were killed on the job. And it seemed very far away for me. You know, I thought those are foreign correspondents. Those are people in other countries. And then this past summer, I took a trip to the museum again, and there were the names of my colleagues. So, no, I didn't expect this to happen. And, I really didn't think about the dangers of journalism in America. That wasn't a thing that anyone talked about up until, I think, very recently.
Around the country, and if you're in a war zone, I think people expect something like this might happen. But also, reporters are not the favorites of many Americans these days. The newsrooms are getting more and more complaints, more and more threats. I think it's fair to say, I don't know if we tracked it in the 60s and 70s. I don't know if we got more back then, but it just seems like anecdotally it's gotten worse.
I think that there's been a history, it goes up and down, of what people generally feel about journalists in America. Things like Watergate can really bring the journalism school attendance way up, but then you also have leaders who are very anti-media, anti-journalists. I think what we're experiencing right now, it's very obvious to say that the president has spoken out against the media, calls us the enemy of the people. yeah, so I think it's pretty clear to take the tone of that. I talked to lots of different people who call the news fake news. Some news is fake news to them, but maybe other news is not fake news to them. That term has really just, I think, blown everything out of proportion. I think it's one of the most difficult times that journalists have seen, but it's also just like when Watergate happened, journalism school attendance, as far as I've seen reported, is way back up again. So people are passionate. It's not all fake news.
Our guest is Celine Sanfelice. She graduated from the University of Tampa in 2016, but she was in the newsroom at the Capital Gazette newspaper last year when a gunman opened fire on she and her colleagues. She'll be speaking tonight at 5 p.m. at the Sykes Chapel on the University of Tampa campus. She'll be receiving a Distinguished Alumni Award. And you're listening to WMNF in Tampa. Celine, when people offer you their thoughts and prayers after this massacre that took the lives of your friends, what do you think?
First of all, the term thoughts and prayers is not my favorite. I don't enjoy it. And if someone says, my thoughts and prayers are with you, are they? Like, but that's not fair. You know, like, I want people to feel like they should be able to support victims of gun violence and victims of mass tragedies. I don't want people to, you know, feel like they can't have sympathy. But I think that it's time now that your sympathy comes with action, because this isn't just a one-off. This isn't just something that happened once and it's hopefully never going to happen again. No, it's going to happen again. It's going to keep happening again because we're not doing anything about it. So I'm not going to dictate for people what their action should be. That action could be just doing something personal and kind for victims of violence. That action could be political, or it could be, you know, something like voting, supporting people that you feel will make a change. It could be offering support to communities that are already affected by gun violence and regularly affected by gun violence. Whatever it is, you know, do whatever you feel you need to do, but do something, because just saying thoughts and prayers and posting on Facebook and hashtagging whatever the most recent tragedy is on Twitter will do nothing, and it's complacent.
Celine, it's not just journalists, and I know you know this probably better than anyone, but it's not just journalists who are victims of mass shootings. It could be anywhere. It could be people watching a concert in Las Vegas. It could be students at a high school in Parkland, or it could be people in a church in Texas and hundreds of other places around the country. Have you heard from anybody who maybe has changed their mind as a result of the tragedy that happened to you and your colleagues at the Capital Gazette? Do you think anybody's mind is being changed by the high level, the almost unbelievable number of mass shootings that take place in the U.S.?
I think people's minds are more likely to be changed in terms of journalism. I think their minds are more likely to be changed about their career when they look at their paycheck rather than when they look at the chances of them being in a violent encounter or the tone of America. This can happen to anyone, anywhere, as we've seen, and but I haven't encountered anyone who has said this changed my mind. I have seen people who are more open about being hesitant in terms of, I feel like my newsroom doesn't have enough security. I feel like I need to speak up about threats that are being sent to our emails and social media. I've seen people who look at what happens to us or look at what happens to other people, and they really question, like, are we doing enough to be safe? But no, I don't think I've encountered anyone who has just said, I'm not going to be a journalist. They've more likely said, I'm nervous about asking my editor for more security.
Yeah. And I was thinking also of people that formerly thought that we had the right to have any sort of gun we wanted who might have changed their minds.
Yeah, actually, I'm not saying that my father is one of those people, but my father is a retired homicide detective, and he's a veteran, and he he and I usually had different opinions, and I think he was always a very, you know, common sense gun laws kind of guy. He doesn't support the NRA, but I mean, he really saw what happens in real life when someone can legally buy a gun. In this case, it was a long gun. When they've had certain charges already on their record, when it hits home for you, you think about it a lot differently. But it's going to hit home for everybody pretty soon.
And Celine, one last question. You'll be speaking at UT tonight. I'm sure a lot of students will come up and talk to you. Maybe there'll be people that you once were on campus with a few years ago. If people say, you know, I don't think I want a future in journalism because now you've got these wild people out there with guns, these hateful people out there with guns, and they're attacking everybody, including journalists. They may not want to become a journalist. What would you say?
I would say, gosh, if you don't want to go into journalism, if you have any hesitations about journalism, not just because of the violence, but because maybe you think it's not right for you, absolutely don't do it, because this is a tough industry and it can be really thankless at times. I mean, not everybody is going to be on the cover of Time magazine, you know, not everybody is going to be able to have their personal voice be heard as a journalist. You give up that right a lot of the time. And you don't get to go to rallies or marches except for when you're covering them. You don't get to post about who you voted for. And if that's important to you, if you don't feel safe, don't do it. But the chances of being in a mass tragedy, you can look them up. I don't know what they are right now compared to what they used to be. But this is not just happening to journalists. The attack on the Capitol Gazette was the deadliest attack on journalists in America, and I hope that it doesn't ever happen again, and I hope that there is a newfound respect for journalists after this. But this happens to schools and churches and movie theaters, and once you're in a shooting and once you've been exposed to gun violence, everywhere you go, you know that you are vulnerable for this. So do whatever you want to do to feel safe, whether it's taking action or not. But this isn't just about journalists. If anything, journalists are giving a voice to people who haven't had that voice for a long time.
And Celine, I got to ask you this question. I mean, I think I can hear it in your voice, is that you are you're probably on guard wherever you go. Do you think?
Yeah.
Do you think that that having a gun, that if you were to arm yourself with a gun, that you would be better protected and have more, be less on guard, less on edge?
For me, no. That the question is no. But I can understand the rationale behind thinking that. I've spent a lot of nights, where I heard a noise and I thought, gosh, I'm just laying in bed and here I am vulnerable. But I don't think that this is my opinion as a person and not a journalist. So let me just clarify that. I personally don't think that more guns in that instance is the answer to the fear. I think if you want to be a responsible gun owner, for whatever your reason is, that's fine. Me, someone with PTSD, I should not have a gun. People with trauma and mental illness and, you know, who can't clearly think to be responsible gun owners should not have guns, in my, Celine Sanfelice, that's it, my opinion. I've had a couple of people say to me, you should have had a gun in that instance, or you should have a gun. And it's different to ask the question, would you feel safer if you had a gun, than to just say to somebody who's had an experience that you have not had, you should have a gun. My father, that was one of the things that he said when I came home from the police station that day was, you should have had a concealed carry. And I said, Dad, I wouldn't have been able to do anything if I had a concealed carry. My dad used to take me to the gun range. He tried to train me. I wasn't interested in learning about guns and I didn't enjoy it. And so he didn't push me towards it. But he admitted in that moment, you're right. I don't think I would have been able to do anything either. That's somebody who is regularly trained in firearms and is a retired police officer. I've had other police officers apparently give me advice saying I should have had a gun in that instance. I thank the first responders, and I wouldn't have lived without them. But you can't impose on somebody that they need to have a gun. That's your personal choice if you want to make that choice. Wendy Winters did not want a gun. She took shooter training, and she did what she learned in shooter training, but she chose not to have a gun. It doesn't make you a weaker person for not wanting to have a gun or for being a victim of violence and not having one. So I just want to put that out there.
Well, Celine, thank you so much for coming on WMNF, and thank you for your bravery.
Thank you so much. Thank you for having me and, giving a voice to people who need it.
That's Celine Sanfelice. She is a staff writer at the Capital Gazette, which is a newspaper in Maryland. That was the scene of one of the worst mass shootings last year. It took place in June of 2018. Five of her fellow newsroom staffers, journalists, were gunned down. She'll be speaking at the University of Tampa tonight at two events, one at 5 o'clock at Sykes Chapel and the other at 6 p.m. at the Loth Entrepreneurship Center. It's part of a symposium about careers in news media. And you're listening to WMNF in Tampa, 88.5 FM. We're live on Facebook. You can find us at Blanny Whalen's Facebook page and also my Facebook page, Rob Lori. This is 88.5 FM. Thanks to those people that are making contributions online, seeing some more contributions come in at WMNF.org. Well, we're going to talk about politics with one of our favorite people, a former host here at WMNF, Daniel Ruth. He's a Pulitzer Prize-winning writer for the Tampa Bay Times. And Dan, nice to see you again. Thanks for coming in.
Well, thank you for having me. I always tell people to go into journalism because it's a license to perpetual adolescence.
So do you have fear of the newsroom? I mean, when you were in the newsroom regularly, did you have a fear of a gunman walking in your...
There were some editors I feared, but no, I never. I worked with a couple of reporters that were packing some heat over the years, but it never dawned on me to... first of all, I don't own a weapon, primarily because I don't believe in it as a matter of principle. And also, I am unbelievably accident-prone. And I would figure out a way to shoot myself with it. So it's just, no, I would never carry.
You know, the Capital Gazette shooting last year, stunning, though.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That somebody who was so angry at his local newspaper would take it out on the newspaper. You've had some angry emails and phone calls.
I've had death threats over the years, you know. But it's just, I just regard it as sort of just part of the job. But no, it happened in Maryland. It was just an unbelievable, horrific moment. And I hope it's not repeated anytime soon.
So I got to ask you about the Tampa mayor's race. I know that you were a moderator at, I think, a city council debate.
In a mayoral debate, both in Forest Hills.
So is this one of the most lackluster Tampa mayoral campaigns?
That's a really interesting point that you mentioned that, because if you go back and look at the history of Tampa mayors, I mean, we've had some that were not exactly a fireball of charisma. I mean, I love Bill Poe very much. He was a good man, but he was not a charismatic figure, and neither was Sandy Friedman, who I do admire. She doesn't think so, but I do. But then we've had these other succession of mayors, you know, like Greco, and Pam Iorio was, I think, a fairly charismatic figure, and Bob Buckhorn, God bless him. I mean, he's been a classic Irish Paul, you know, running the city. And so this time around, we have two candidates in Jane Castor and David Strauss, who, you know, they're I think they're both good people, and they, but they're no Dick Greco, if you want to put it that way. But the thing about, I mean, and I think Jane Castor, she brings a lot to the table. I think she barely just missed winning the whole thing outright just a few weeks ago. And she knows the city very well, and she knows how to run a large bureaucracy like a police department. And she certainly has had some missteps along the way. In a long career, that's going to happen. We all have missteps in a long career along the way. The thing that's always bothered me about Straz is that when you're worth $440 million or whatever it is, why in God's name would you want to be mayor of Tampa and have to deal with the minutiae and the nuts and bolts and people stopping you and complaining about potholes and this and that. I know he probably looks at the job as some sort of big picture thing, and he'll hire minions, you know, to take care of the potholes. But that's not what the Tampa mayor's job really is. It's a, you know very well, you've lived here for so long, that the mayor, it's a touchy-feely job. People want to go up and look their mayor in the eye and shake their hand and have a physical relationship.
See her in the grocery store.
That's right.
Yeah,
that's right. And I just don't think Stras quite appreciates the nitty gritty aspects of the job. I think he thinks, oh, we're going to build the great, you know, it can be Robert Moses or something of Tampa.
Would it be fair to say that both campaigns are a little vague? I mean, they're both good people, as you mm-hmm. said, but in terms of what they want to accomplish, vague on what...
But, you know, it's self-evident what you need to accomplish if you're mayor of Tampa. I mean, if you look at this city, there are you have Vinickville going on here, and that's going to transform downtown Tampa over the next several years. That's an obvious issue that a mayor has to deal with, development and economic growth and all that. Transportation is a huge issue that no mayor has been able to solve, and it will now fall to probably Jane Castor to take that on. So things of that nature, and in the neighborhoods, you know, the Stras got into a little trouble when he first got into the race of not quite even knowing where East and West Tampa were. You know, it was north of Kennedy. That's about all he probably knew. And so there's this constant, these neighborhoods want to be nurtured, and they want to be paid attention to. And that's always a challenge for a mayor.
Well, one of Stras's complaints is that Bob Buckhorn didn't take care of the neighborhoods, that he spent all his time helping to go after Vinickville mm-hmm. and go after that big park on the mm-hmm. west side of the river mm-hmm. and spend a lot mm-hmm. of money. So Stras made the complaint at several of the forums that I was at that Bob Buckhorn forgot about the neighborhoods.
It has been a fair argument as long as I've lived here and as long as you have lived here, is that economic development, especially in East Tampa, has always gone wanting. And we've had a lot of people, a lot of mayors, a lot of civic leaders, a lot of graybeards talk about the need for economic development in this very neighborhood where we sit.
Yeah, in East Tampa,
and other areas of the eastern part of the city, which is predominantly populated by people of color and so forth. And every mayor has given lip service to that issue. And we talk about economic opportunities and economic opportunity zones and all that stuff, and it sounds great. But very little of it seems to get accomplished. And so every mayor that I'm aware of during my time here has talked about that, and I have never really seen an appreciable improvement in that area.
Yeah, the issue here in East Tampa, where we are, is the lack of a big grocery store. There's mm-hmm. There's one down the street, but if you live deep into the neighborhood
That's
in
right.
East Tampa, there's almost no grocery store.
South St. Petersburg deals yeah. with the exact same issue, mm-hmm. and the grocery stores make the argument that, well, you know, it's not economically viable for us to put a Publix, you know, in the middle. Yeah. But you need to figure out a way to provide those sorts of incentives.
You know, it struck me that the also-rans in the mayor's race had these big binders full of ideas. Binders and binders, right? They had ideas, uh-huh. but they didn't catch on. You know, for instance, Harry Cohen.
Right.
I think a lot of ideas.
Harry Cohen would have been a very fine mayor of Tampa. And if I was whoever wins this race, I would find a place for Harry Cohen in my administration, either as the city attorney or in some of deputy mayor. No mayor ever creates the title of deputy mayor or vice mayor. Kreisman does over in St. Petersburg. But to find a role for Harry Cohen, I think, would be critical, because he does understand the minutiae and the nitty-gritty of government, of governance of this city. He has a lot of experience working for Pat Frank, of course, and then on city council. I would try to find a role for him to play in any city administration.
Let's take some phone calls. Our phone number is 813-239-9663. Daniel Ruth is here of the Tampa Bay Times, Pulitzer Prize winning journalist, and this is 88.5 FM. I'm Rob Lurie. Thanks for tuning in. I was surprised how big that field was. Did you go to, I mean, was anything outrageous said at the forum that you moderated there up in Forest Hills?
No, I don't recall anything particularly. I did ask a question during the forum about what is the probability that we will have a mass transit system in place in the city before I'm dead? And the answer was, well, not on your timetable, pal, probably. But
all of the six or eight candidates?
Because I'm almost 70. I'll be 70 in September. And so the idea that, you know, if, even if we were to embark on had the funding and everything in place, the probability of having a light rail system fully operational in my lifetime is probably slim to none. But there was that. I mean, they're all in favor of it, of course, you know.
You know,
especially the Tarantrics of the world.
Yeah.
Those guys.
I've heard Castor go back and forth on the question, because at one of the forums I was at, she said, well, let's buy the CSX lines and let's put
which
rail.
Which is what Tarantric wants
right.
to do. Yeah.
And then at another forum, I saw her speak, and she was back to buses. Mm-hmm. So I wasn't quite sure.
Well, I think it is not it is within the realm of possibility that when the VNIC project gets completed, at least we will have a more functional rail system looping through downtown
the trolley
Tampa,
system.
The trolley system,
yeah.
And perhaps up through Tampa Heights and down around the city again, and that would be at least a step. You know, I get to Chattanooga sometimes because of my son-in-law's property up there, and they have a wonderful system. It loops around downtown Chattanooga, and it's free. You just get on, get off, and go. Mm-hmm. I could see us perhaps getting that sort of thing done. And then once you do that, if you have that working, well, then you can make arguments about, well, we need to have an extension out to the airport, and maybe an extension up to USF or down to wherever, in the Hyde Park.
So I noticed that the new head of Hart is coming in, and he was once at Phoenix. They often compare Phoenix and Tampa. I've never been to Phoenix, so I don't know.
It's been a long time since I've been to Phoenix.
Yeah, but they talk about the suburban nature of Phoenix. They put in a rail system, and apparently it's pretty successful.
Yeah. It just takes time for people to acclimate themselves to the. It's new, you know. Yeah. So people takes a little while for people to get away from the car. And my son is about to leave Tampa and move to North Carolina, and he plans to get rid of his car.
Going to Charlotte?
Durham,
yeah. Do they have a good rail system?
And he plans to get rid of his car because he travels a lot anyway for his job and doesn't really want a car.
It's a huge expense.
Yeah.
And again, our phone number, 813-239-9663. You're listening to WMNF in Tampa. And thanks to Frank Knox. He's our phone producer today. Blanny Whalen has put us up on Facebook, so you can watch Dan and me without makeup. You look better than me. I was looking at the camera. You're much better looking than
That's
I am.
Not
yeah.
true. That's so, not true. You have that...
Don't go there. Don't even start. So
you're a sex symbol. Let's just put it
so the I think one of the hopes of the Straz campaign is to point out Jane Castor's record as police chief as being horrible for the African American community, and pull out a lot of African American votes in the upcoming April 23rd election, and maybe swing the race to his side. I think that's
That may be his strategy. He has a lot of road to make up there, and I think, you know, there was the Times that broke the Biking While Black story, and Castor has done, I think, a fair job of making amends for that and apologizing for it and admitting it was wrong or it was taken a little bit to excess and so forth and so on. So there's that. We were talking before we went on the air about this shooting that the cops were involved in. These things happen in any big city police department. Unfortunately, these things do happen.
Yeah, I want to say the shooting was, I believe the young man's name was Jason Wet Scott, about 22 years old, small time marijuana guy, if at all, he possessed a little bit of marijuana. His house had been broken into in Tampa Heights or Riverside Heights, and the police said, "Well, get a gun." And he was fingered as a major drug dealer by a police informant. They sent a SWAT team to Jason's house and looking for a big time drug dealer. Yeah, he had two joints in the house, and he raised his gun to protect himself and was shot dead.
And this idea that you'd have to treat a suspect like this as if he's Pablo Escobar is nuts. I mean, there are all kinds of ways he could have easily arrested this guy without incident. When he came out in the morning to get in his car, they could have taken him down or stopped him and make a traffic stop or whatever. This was, I don't know all the details. I don't pretend to be knowledgeable about this, but I mean, it really was a case of excessive overkill. But I would say this. I was watching Channel 8 last night. They were doing a story about some cops apparently have gotten into trouble. They were like disposing of evidence, just making a small-time drug bust, and they were just tossed the joiner away when they should have been filing it and doing a report and doing the paperwork, and maybe there's more to it than that. This happened on Chief Dugan's watch. Does this undermine Chief Dugan's credibility as the chief because he had... No, it doesn't. I mean, his...
But aren't all the things that happen under your watch really... A good leader would take responsibility for everything under their watch,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, and I think Dugan probably will when all the facts are in. I'm sure he probably will.
I want to let our Sarasota and Lakeland and St. Petersburg and Tarpon Springs listeners in on this, too. Let me just ask you a quick question about state government, too, which you pay attention to. Tallahassee, this year, what do you think? I mean, we've had... legislature after conservative legislature, any different this year?
Well, the difference probably is the governor. I mean, he's a conservative Republican. There's no doubt about it. I mean, that's very true. But DeSantis has at least floated some signals that he's not a doctrinaire right-wing Republican. He's been willing to talk about, he's mentioned the words climate change, you know, which is a major step forward for this, for this state, this governor.
Yeah.
And he's expressed some willingness to reach across the aisle to get some things done, and that's a good thing.
The legislature is moving towards rolling back a bit, actually a major bit of Amendment 4. That was the amendment
which is outrageous, absolutely outrageous, and the people of the state of Florida, by what, 67% approved Amendment 4 to restore the voting rights of convicted felons once they serve their sentences. And there are exclusions, of course. If you've been convicted of murder or rape or some stuff, you don't qualify. It was a very measured, very reasonable thing, and it was voted overwhelmingly in a bipartisan fashion. 67% of the vote approved it, and the people have spoken. And the idea that the Florida legislature then comes in behind them, and they've done this before on other amendments, that we saw this with other school class sizes and stuff like that. But this time around, you know, we hear all this lip service from these guys. Well, we respect the will of people. You hear this all the time. The citizens of Florida, they're intelligent and they're smart and they're brave and courageous and bold and they're wonderful people. And when they speak, we must pay attention unless we don't like what they say. And then we're going to change everything, and this is just not right. And I was a little, I wasn't quite ready to sign on to this idea that unless you pay your fines and so forth that you can't vote, as being defined as a poll tax. But the more I think about it, yes, it is. It is a variation of the poll tax.
Yeah, the question for me is, they're not going to be able to vote unless they pay these court costs.
Mm-hmm.
And the question for me is, who assigns the court costs? Does the judge?
The court does.
The judge assigns the
mm-hmm.
court costs?
I believe so.
Or does every county have a rule says to the judge, "Hey, judge, you've got to add this."
Every county may have a bill of fare of what different offenses cost that the judge can apply.
This is the way they keep taxes low.
Yes,
because
judges can waive that. Judges can also waive that. Mm-hmm. I mean, I would imagine in many cases. So this idea that they come in behind the voters after an overwhelming majority of them voted, this is voter suppression. And Florida is very, very good at voter suppression. We've seen it time and time again.
Yeah, 1.5 million people would be eligible, but I think the number goes way down to the tens of thousands if this measure goes through.
But even in the tens of thousands, if you want to be cynical about it, in a state like Florida, tens of thousands can swing an election in this state. But if I was the governor, I would veto that. Legislation.
Our phone number is 813-239-9663. You're listening to WMNF Radioactivity. I'm Rob Lori. Thanks for tuning in. Daniel Ruth is with me. He's the Pulitzer Prize winning journalist from the Tampa Bay Times and one of several Pulitzer Prize winners over at the Times.
Quite a few.
Yep. Let's go to Vivian in Tampa. Hey, Vivian, you're on with Dan. What's your question?
Hi, Yes, good morning. I just want to make a comment on the beginning of your conversation. I lived in downtown Tampa in a community that are for over 62, and they have no stores here in downtown. And it is so hard for the senior citizens. Sometimes they just have to go to those little combinations of gas stations, groceries, and spend more money because things are more expensive. And yes, I would like whoever it is, Chase Faster or Strath, to please consider to put at least a grocery store, a big grocery store that everybody can go, you know.
I have to say, when this was tried in South St. Petersburg, Mayor Kreisman, to his credit, was able to persuade, I think it was a Winn-Dixie, came into South St. Petersburg, and the grocery chain put a lot of effort into it. It was a very nice store. They hired local people to, and it just did not succeed.
Yeah. Vivian, you live in Tampa, and you don't have a grocery store in downtown Tampa?
Right.
Yeah, you know, there's a Publix. Let me ask you this. There's a Publix going in Channels. Go ahead.
We haven't opened it
right,
yet.
It's not open yet. Right.
Have you been to Duckweed?
And Publix is a little bit expensive. You all know that. I mean, it's great. I love it.
What a lot of people don't know is there is a grocery store in downtown Tampa called Duckweed.
Really?
Yes.
It's in Channelside.
Tampa Street.
Tampa Street. There's two of them, I think.
Yeah. There is a growth. Yeah, I think you're right. Yeah. There is a young couple started. It's called Duckweed. It's right next to the Starbucks in downtown Tampa. And they...
I know you're not going to say it's expensive, but remember, these are senior citizens on Social Security.
I'm a senior citizen on Social Security too. So
Vivian, I think people hear you loud and clear. You want an affordable grocery store in Tampa that's in downtown Tampa, within walking distance of where you live.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. We hear you. All right, Vivian. Thank you.
And
thank
if
you
elected, I will make sure that that gets done.
Vivian, great to hear from you. Let's go to John in Port Richey. Hey, John, you're on WMNF. What's your question?
Thanks for the show. Mr. Ruth made a comment about the gentleman who was worth like $400 million and why would he run for office. To me, that sort of sounded like you're saying that running for office is all about making the money and not public service.
Look, I'm just being practical. Let me ask, how old are you?
55.
Okay. All right. Let's say you're 76 years old, as Mr. Straz is. You're worth $440 million. You have houses all over the place. You have a couple golf streams. You're on the board of directors of the Metropolitan Opera. Why in God's name would you want to spend your time being mayor of Tampa?
Because maybe he thinks he can bring forth good ideas and help that community.
Well, you can do that without being mayor of Tampa. He's been doing it since the day he got here.
Oh, okay. So wait a minute. So when people are complaining about changing the system and people say, well, run for office and change it.
Okay.
Well, they shouldn't run for office? Is that what you're saying?
If he wants to run for office, God bless him. I'm just telling, I guess I'm, you know what? I take your point. It's a fair one. Maybe I'm projecting my own values onto this. But if I was 76 years old and I was worth $440 million, the last thing in the world I'd want to be doing would be schlepping down to City Hall every
day.
Out in the golf course. I'd be in Monaco with our friend Stephen Saltzman.
Oh, we should tell that story. So, John, let me ask you this.
He did it for himself.
John, let me ask you this. You live in Port Richey. What do you think the people of Tampa really need from the next mayor? What would you say the city of Tampa needs?
I think what the city needs is probably what the state needs, is a good transportation system, a good health care system, a good housing system for affordable housing, jobs, good jobs, not just these $2 an hour jobs or jobs where you got to work three jobs to make your end meet. I mean, that's pretty much what any community needs. Now, Tampa itself, some people were mentioning that Publix or the grocery stores. I lived in St. Pete for a long time, and I remember when they tried to put one, Publix said, no, we're not going to put one on the south side because it was, quote, uneconomical, quote. But I think there are other reasons, because I think they're afraid of the riots in the community. That was my personal opinion. But that's what you need. You need somebody that's focused on the community, whether it's state or local.
All right. John, thanks a lot. Thanks for coming.
That call reminded me. You remember during the campaign where Straz said that he was very upset that he thought Tampa was run by a clique,
right. Yep.
Which he's been part of for about the past 25 years.
Every
city from Tampa to Tuaeg always has a cadre of people. Business people, or the gray beards behind in the community that sort of operate as a kitchen cabinet to whoever the mayor is. We refer to it in Tampa colloquially as the Palmacia crowd.
Right.
But that every city has a group of business people who kind of whisper in the ear of the mayor about what
Straz was on Buckhorn's transition team, and now they're on opposite sides.
Yeah, right?
So he was an insider.
And he was a close confidant of Dick Greco.
We talked about the killing of the young man. Anonymous in 352 writes, he raised a gun at cops. He deserves to be shot dead. End of story, writes Anonymous. And then Janelle writes regarding the grocery store at Tangerine Plaza. She says it was a Sweet Bay originally.
Sweet Bay.
All right.
Which is Winn-Dixie, I think. Or they changed the name, or didn't they change the name?
Yeah, I think Winn-Dixie bought a lot of the Sweet Bays.
Can't keep track.
And then 813 Anonymous writes, duckweed is expensive. All right, so thank you. Hey, Dan, before we go, you mentioned Stephen Saltzman. The other day I was watching 60 Minutes.
Me too.
And it was 2 weeks ago on a Sunday, and there was a former WMNF volunteer. He had hosted the one of the afternoon shows. We were playing a lot of jazz
back
and blues and R&B in the afternoon, back in the early 80s. Guy's name is Stephen Saltzman, a British guy who was going to St. Pete Junior College at the time.
And eventually went to USF.
And there he is on 60 Minutes touting the lifestyle in Monaco.
The lifestyle of the rich and famous.
This is one of the MNF volunteers. It was not our usual volunteer.
No, he wasn't. Yeah. And I was around in those days, too. And I did his show on occasion, because he was a jazz fan. I was a jazz fan. Stephen Saltzman is the son of the late Harry Saltzman, who was the co-producer of the James Bond films. And Harry lived on a house that sat on two lots in Coffee Pot Bayou. And he was the co-producer for the first five or six Bond movies, I think.
Yeah, and then he and Broccoli had a bit of a falling out,
and he had moved to St. Petersburg and was doing other things. And one weekend, we all knew Stephen, and a very nice young man, and really just a nice kid. And at one point, Michael Caine came to Tampa to spend a weekend with the Saltzmans. They were friends. And I got all these calls from the National Enquirer.
You're writing for the Tampa Tribune.
I'm the film critic for the Tampa Tribune. And, we understand Stephen Saltzman. Where's Michael Caine staying? And I wouldn't give him up. And so afterward, Stephen thanked me for that. And he said, boy, if there's anything I can ever do for you, let me know. And I said, well, there is. And I said, I'd like to interview your father. And he said, no problem. So he arranged it, and I drove over to St. Petersburg and spent a lovely afternoon with Harry Saltzman. He told these lovely, great stories about Bond and the arguments he and Broccoli had over who to replace Sean Connery with and all that stuff. And at one point he said, I got to go pick somebody up at the airport. Why don't you come with me? And we went out, and we got in his Rolls Royce with the steering wheel, English version. The steering wheel was on the right-hand side. And we were joking before, Sean Connery may be a master at handling an Aston Martin, but Harry couldn't drive worth a hill of beans. And this Rolls Royce is swerving all over the Howard Franklin as we're making our way to, because he'd be looking at me, talking to me, and not really paying attention. And somehow we made it to the airport. And we pulled up to the arrivals, and he just parked in a no parking zone right in front of the arrivals door. And we walked in, and I can't repeat verbatim what Harry said, but I said, Harry, I said, you parked your Rolls Royce in this no parking. Aren't you worried that it's going to get towed? And he looked at me like I had a hole in the head. He said, they're not going to toll a Rolls Royce. Are you crazy? And sure enough, they didn't. We were in the airport for maybe a half hour before the flight arrived. We came out. The car was just sitting there,
Steve was probably the richest volunteer we ever had here at WI.
No, atypical.
I mean, we've got people that work with the homeless. We've got people who are activists and all that. And,
and apparently he's become quite the bon vivant and the unofficial mayor of Monaco.
People should look up that 60 Minutes to see the former MNF volunteer. Daniel Ruth is here, and you're listening to Radioactivity.
Are we going
to
talk about Mueller at all?
Tampa. If you want.
I have a theory. A theory about Mueller. I mean, I don't know what's in this report, neither does anybody else, you know. And it's cracked me up watching everybody from Rachel Maddow to Sean Hannity trying to fill up a couple hours of airtime every night talking about something that nobody knows anything about, you know. And so I hope that Mr. Barr does release the message. But here's my prediction. I'm probably wrong. Soon. I can't put a date. This provides Donald Trump the perfect cover to begin to pardon Manafort and Flynn and all these other people who got caught up in this. Because if, by Trump's reasoning, if the Mueller report is illegitimate because it found, in his view, no collusion, then everything else is the fruit from the poison tree. All these other convictions and guilty pleas and so forth stem from, and I'm simply guessing what Trump would say, came from a tainted investigation in the first place. Therefore, all these guilty pleas and convictions are illegitimate, and he'll grant a bunch of pardons.
Oh, well, you know, do you think that there's a little bit of the jumping of the gun here with Barr's four-page summary of what Mueller's actually found? We don't know what Mueller's found.
I listen to Limbaugh every now and then just to help me drink more heavily they're talking about this is an exoneration and so on. No one has read the report.
Well,
nobody.
Now the Republicans and President Trump are calling for Adam Schiff to resign from the House Intelligence Committee.
Yeah, he'll resign just like Devin Nunes.
And they've
resigned.
Got a whole list of Congress members CIA people that they're telling networks stay away from these people.
Right. And that's not going to happen. Yeah. But it's been hysterical trying to watch everybody on the right and the left try to fill up time guesstimating what's in this report.
Do you think we'll actually see the entire report?
Or do you think that... If I were Barr, since Donald Trump himself had said, I have no problem releasing this, if I were Barr, I'd say, well, if the president doesn't have a problem with it, here you are.
Yeah, but he's Trump's guy.
But you could simply say, well, the president doesn't seem to have a problem with this, so here you go. Have a nice time.
Let's take some phone calls. Let's go to...
I just wanted to get that off my chest.
Thank you. Let's go to John in Hudson. John, you're on with Daniel Ruth.
Hi, Dan. Hi, Rob. When I turned on the radio a little bit ago, Dan, I love your columns, what you're writing, and your when you're on the radio. But today, I gotta admit, Rob, hearing your voice, just the sun rose again today.
And the angels sang.
They did. I mean, I was so mad when I found out.
John, can you verify that you're not my cousin, John?
I am not your cousin, Rob. But I tell you what, when I came home, the first day that I was on my way home and I heard that you were not on the air anymore, I got out of the car and my wife looked at me. She goes, what's the matter? And I guess it was like, you know, marble red in the face. And I was just like, I can't believe they did that. And like I said, Daniel said it great. The angels sang. Hearing your voice back on the air.
And the eagle soared.
John, thank you. Thank you. We're trying to heal the place down
here.
The seas
parted.
John, thank you. But
water was turned into wine.
See, now people are going to get sick of this in about 5 minutes,
the loaves
right?
and the fishes multiplied. And
the station would have not have been the same without you, without a doubt.
John, thank you. Thank you. That's very kind of you. Thank you.
And keep up the fantastic work.
Well, I promise.
Both of you.
Yeah, well, we got to get Dan Ruth back on the air somehow once in a while to talk about politics. Daniel Ruth is here. John, thanks. Daniel Ruth is here, and he's a Pulitzer Prize-winning columnist at the Tampa Bay Times. And let's go to Mion in Tampa. Mion, you're on with Dan. What's your question?
Terrific. Welcome back, Rob.
Thank you.
I just want to do a quick caveat on the voter suppression. I'm 65, and I voted for McGovern Shriver the first time youngsters were allowed to vote. And long story short, I was going to vote in my precinct. This is when Rick Kreisman was in the primary in St. Petersburg. And I was asked for two forms of ID. And I mean, I have a master's degree. I didn't just roll off the turn-up truck. And I said to the guy, no, I just need one, because I showed him my license. He said, you need another one. I said, no, I don't. I had worked at HCC before I retired, and I just happened to have my employee ID. I said, there, because I couldn't really fight with them because I had to get to work. And so as soon as I got to work, I called the supervisor of elections office. I got a recording. I said, hey, listen, this guy asked me for two forms of ID, and I'm thinking, if he's doing that to me, who else would be doing that to? I was just so irate.
You should be.
Yes, very, very much so. And anyways, I just wanted to pass that on to you.
And you never got any response from the supervisor of elections there in Pinellas County?
No, I got a recording, but the next time I happened to vote at my precinct, that person was not. I didn't see him there, thank God.
That's good.
And B, he sure as hell wasn't checking IDs. And nobody, that was the first and last time I was ever asked for a second ID.
Well, we got to get to the bottom of that. Mion, thanks a lot. Thank you.
Okay, guys, keep up the good work.
Thank you for that. And let's go to John in St. Pete. Hey, John, you're on. What's your question?
I just wanted to say it's so great to hear your voice, Rob. I'm so grateful that they brought you back and everything is doing
thank
good.
You. Thank
and
you.
I'm a lifelong resident of St. Pete. I was born here. And I've been listening to MNF ever since you started it.
And the amazing thing about this, what a lot of people don't know about Rob, is that off air, he sounds like Elmer Fudd. It's an amazing transition that takes place once he gets behind the microphone.
Yeah.
Well, it's very, very angry.
John, thanks a lot. John, thank you.
Gonna kill it.
Have you noticed the problem with the mayors in Newport Richey?
Why can't they be mayor of Tampa?
that would give us more to write about.
Oh man, I think we should write those guys in, both of them, and they come. You want some, you know,
your entertainment?
Let's get those guys to come down here and run for mayor of Tampa. Like their talents are misplaced up there.
This is the sleepiest mayor's race ever. Let's go to David in California. David, you're on MNF.
Oh, morning. Yeah, I was listening. Pretty interesting, the whole discussion about the guns. I, you know, was raised without guns. I had a bunch of relatives who were in World War II, and two of them blew their brains out. One was a master sergeant, one was a major. And they realized during Vietnam that the... you know, that there was treason in the works. This is not just some discussion among Americans about whether or not to have guns. These guns are coming in for people who want to have a coup in America. I don't know if you remember the old book from the 1960s called Ecotopia. Ernest Kallenbach wrote it. But it's basically something like a science fiction book in which America falls apart to these major corporations like mining companies and lumber companies and whatnot that carve up America, and they're going to have their own empires, and they basically put together armies so that they can carve up America. And Ecotopia is the Northern California, Washington, Oregon.
Well, you know, these sorts of conspiracy theories, I think there is a touch of credibility to what the caller is talking about, that the gun control debate has nothing to do with about the Second Amendment. It has to do with this irrational fear that the government wants to take your guns away so they can suppress you.
And that's why we have to have all these guns. I believe that it's actually a coup. You know, if you go back to the time of John F. Kennedy's assassination, one of the suspects was the Hunt brothers, famous Texas landholding family that had...
I know. Boy, you know, that's an old radio thing. If you want to really stimulate calls, just mention the UFOs, the Federal Reserve, or the Kennedy assassination. Uh-huh. And if it's true, thank God my wife has dual citizenship in Greece.
All right. You know, David, we're at the very end of the show, and I got to say thank you for the phone call. Thank you.
Well, sure. It's just that, you know, when 25 million guns get shot or get sold within 2 weeks after the Connecticut school shooting, 25 million guns in 2 weeks get sold,
right,
there's a coup in the works. That's not a whole bunch of individuals. Yeah. That's somebody buying tens of thousands of them.
All right. Yeah. All right. Well, you know, I do see from time to time on TV where people say that if President Trump is impeached, that he'll rally his people around the country and stir him up.
His election was one of the worst things that happened to the gun industry.
That's
gun
true.
Sales went down. They went way up when Obama was elected. They started to go down after Trump came in because people thought, oh, well, we're good now. We're good to go.
And there were all those rumors that President Obama was going to take your guns, and it turned out not to be true.
Wish he would.
Daniel, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
So when did your column run in the Tampa Bay Times?
It runs the week after whenever Bill Maxwell runs.
All right, so after
usually
Bill?
The second week of the month.
All right, so you can look for Daniel Ruth at TampaBay.com. Dan, thanks a lot.
I hope you come back
after the legislature really decides what they're going to do with us. Thank you. It's good to be back. And I'm Rob Lori. If you want to comment about today's show, please call us at 813-238-8001 and record your comment on extension 115. And I'll play your comments back tomorrow morning at 11 o'clock. Thanks to Blanny Whalen and Frank Knox for assisting the program. Stay tuned for your hero, Mark Biro. He's coming up next right here on WMNF Tampa.